I think that this was actually a mistake I made when I first took on an executive role, where I really expected to show up representing my function. And fairly quickly I went, oh, this is the wrong way to think about this. Once I sort of switched and said, hey, this is a team that's trying to solve a problem together. And most of the time we actually can kind of like set aside the hat that we wear when we're out in the rest of the company and just sort of work together as, you know, five people who have different expertise but are trying to solve the same problem. And that ended up being a much healthier approach.
How do the best software engineering organizations in the world set and track goals? Linear B worked with more than 3,000 orgs to effectively track their KPIs and set goals. And March 26th and 28th, Linear B's CTO, Yishai Berry, is hosting a workshop to share those best practices with our fellow engineering leaders. This workshop will delve into the data behind effective goal setting, strategies elite engineering organizations use, successful companies that are using goal setting, plus provide a free how-to guide and reporting slide deck for you to leverage. You can register today at the link in the description. I hope to see you there. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to DevInterrupted, live from Leading Edge SF. I'm your co-host, Connor Bronson, and I'm joined today by Emily Nakashima. Emily is the VP of Engineering at Honeycomb.io, also known as Honeycomb. Emily, thanks for coming on the show.
Really happy to be here.
It's my pleasure because you have a background in product engineering, performance optimization, client-side monitoring, design, and I love that you kind of describe yourself as this dev tools nerd, because frankly, so are we here. We love talking to folks like yourself. And I understand that you have identified a misconception that you're seeing in how we all apply not just dev tools, but dev organizations. Because we talk a lot about how CTO roles can vary company to company. Some CTOs sit over multiple VPs of engineering and they're running the whole engineering org. Others have a kind of special ops group. Or, you know, maybe some other roles here where they're focused on security. There's a variety of ways you can look about it, depending on the size of the company, type of company. Yet we like to think about VPs of engineering as kind of standard. Like, okay, you're a VP of engineering. Yeah, your size of the company may be different. You don't think that's the case. You think there's a difference between VP of engineering across the board.
I do think that. And I don't think it's just developer tools companies. I really think, especially startups, but really any kind of like scaling company, I think so often the roles are really defined by who's there and what the organization does well. You know, there's this real understanding because we've sort of, I think, idolized founders and CTOs that we have sort of become more aware of all the different shapes. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the reality is that the VP of engineering could take on almost as many shapes as the CTO. And I don't want people to miss that because I think like people can either be drawn to the opportunity for the wrong reasons or they can sort of think it's not for them because they have the wrong picture in their head of what it could be.
Well, let me just say to VPs of engineering who are watching and listening, we think about you too. We're big fans. And that's why, Emily, I'm really glad you're here to kind of talk to us about some of this almost antiquated views of the role that we have. How do you think about the VP of engineering role? How does it break down for you?
I do think that, you know, some of the kind of sort of maybe stereotype that people have in their head, there is some truth in that. Like, I think in general, this idea that the VP of engineering is the lead manager for either engineering as a whole in a smaller company or, you know, a portion of the technical teams in a larger company, it rounds to true most places, I think.
Right.
I think that the thing that people miss is how much the actual role is shaped by other people on the leadership team.
Okay.
And sometimes other people who aren't in the leadership team too. Probably if you think about the VP and CTO relationship, that kind of like makes more sense naturally to people. Like, I work with Charity Majors, who's Honeycomb's CTO. Charity is very well known to come from a really strong operational background. She was a DBA at one point. You know, right. She was like a sysadmin back in the day. She understands backend engineering very well. And so when I tell people, hey, because Charity has that background, I can kind of come from more of a front-end background, be more of a specialist in like engineering and product collaboration. That makes a lot of sense. But a thing that people miss that I think is really important is that I can also have my role because we had some early employees at the company who were relatively senior, who also had really strong operational chops, who made sure that the platform was like running reliably, who made sure that we didn't have major architectural challenges. And because those weren't the top concerns, when they went to go pick a VP of engineering, I had a profile that made sense. So I think it's really, you know, it's up, down, and sideways that all kind of like shape the role. It's not just who's the CTO, which I think people focus on.
That's a really great point, that there are all these different dimensions we don't necessarily think about. And you also mentioned the interactions with other organizations, other business units, and how that impacts how the role of VP of engineering functions. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, I think that people really, like I said, focus on that VPN CTO relationship. I see that same sort of reciprocal shaping happening with the VP of product as well. Sometimes you have a really strong VP of product and then there's sort of a healthy tension between the two roles and they're sort of shaped in opposition to each other.
Usually healthy.
Or, you know, tension of some sort, one flavor or another. And then sometimes, you know, you have a product function that, you know, maybe engineering has been at the company for longer. The product function is a little less mature. And then the VP of engineering is almost senior to the VP of product. And there's a little bit more of a, you know, you're sort of under my umbrella kind of relationship. But it can be really different. And no matter what the shape of the VP of product is, it always shapes that VP of engineering role in turn. To a lesser extent, it's true for other roles on the senior leadership team as well.
Yeah, I'm not an executive, but I imagine that when you're in that executive leadership meeting, you are reacting differently depending on the strengths and weaknesses of that whole team. And you're asked to do different things depending on the strengths and weaknesses of that team. That's been my experience, you know, the one time I did found a company and that didn't go well, let's just say, listeners. I wonder how you've seen that impact you personally in your role.
Yeah, you know, I think that this is actually a mistake I made when I first took on an executive role where I really expected to show up representing my function, you know, and fairly quickly I went, oh, this is the wrong way to think about this. Once I sort of switched and said, hey, this is a team that's trying to solve a problem together. And most of the time we actually can kind of like set aside the hat that we wear when we're out in the rest of the company and just sort of work together as, you know, five people who have different expertise but are trying to solve the same problem. That ended up being a much healthier approach. And then it's not about like, I represent engineering, you represent marketing. It's like, you're the funny one who's going to add levity when we're all like arguing with each other, or I'm the person who's going to remember to like retrospect and look back. Like that kind of stuff often comes much more to the forefront. And having that sort of balance and sort of like skill set and perspective, I think is as important as the kind of functional balance.
I just want to say it's very kind of you to picture me as the funny one. So thank you for that. I don't know if it's deserved, but it sounds like you have a few different archetypes in mind as far as how VPs of engineering function, depending on company size, makeup, et cetera. What are those different archetypes?
I feel like the more I dig, the more I find more ones. I'll say I'm more of a startup person, and there really is a big difference between being the VP of engineering at a smaller company versus being a VP of engineering at a bigger company. I know a little bit about that divide, but I haven't been that VP of engineering at a bigger company. And I think that, you know, it can really change. Often at a larger company, you have a much bigger scope. You know, you have more people under you and you are managing a lot more complexity. Cross-functional relationships are often more complex. But in some ways, you also have less autonomy. You know, you can't just go rewrite the travel policy on a whim on a Friday afternoon, you know? So that really can shape the role. I think you get a wider array of archetypes sometimes at smaller companies.
Totally.
And then you get more, there's such a range of from internal facing to external facing. Oh, trailblaze versus steward is a dynamic I really like. My COO, Jeff Gray, uses that description of the two different possible flavors where the trailblazer is the person who is like out, you know, innovating new technology, like coming up with new product lines. And then someone needs to be in that steward position where they're like, this is the product that makes us money today.
Yes.
I'm going to make sure it keeps doing that, you know?
And I imagine there's this, I mean, use this phrase, healthy tension with the role when there's technical co-founders too. So, I mean, like I'll say like Linear B, we have a VP of engineering. We also have a CEO as a former VP of engineering. We have a CPO as a former VP of engineering. So this creates different dynamics than I'm sure other companies where maybe it's a more business-minded co-founder. Not to say that our co-founders aren't business-minded, but maybe they came from sales and have hired a VP of engineering to build out the product. That absolutely will create a different dynamic in product and engineering organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of times, like where the vision comes from can be the biggest thing that kind of shifts around. And I think often if you have founders in those roles, they can often like look into the far future forever and tell you like what the product should be. And then, you know, if you get to a certain point where all of a sudden that's a hat that needs to be assigned to a specific executive and that wasn't what you were hiring for,
yeah,
you like hired that person into the role, that can be an interesting thing that really kind of forces people to grow or sometimes forces a change.
So how do you identify the archetype that your company needs when you come on board or when you're hiring, I suppose?
It's a good question. I'll say when I was sort of a manager, a director, senior IC, I was not tuned into the, you know, even to the idea that I could ask my VP of engineering to be different or that I could evaluate whether the organization had picked the right shape. And only now I look back and I see, you know, moments where we really had the right shape of person for the job and moments when we didn't, and it made a big difference to the health of the company. It's hard to do when people have such a narrow understanding of the job. The big thing I would look for if I were trying to understand that is really those cross-functional relationships and how they're working, and especially which ones seem to be strong and which ones seem to be like there's not connective tissue there, or they're fraying a little bit. You know, that's often the biggest clue that something needs to change, where like, you know, maybe you see an organization where you really think product and engineering need to be tight, or engineering really needs to be, you know, very closely aligned with the revenue goals and shipping certain things that, you know there's revenue behind, and you don't see that happening. Those kinds of things are often the sort of the really concrete warning signs that maybe there's been a misalignment in the shape.
And I imagine the needs, I mean, we know the needs evolve over time for roles. So I can see how this would really shift as organizations grow and scale.
One of the interesting things about being a startup VP versus potentially being in a bigger company is like the pace at which you need to kind of become an entirely different shape or archetype can be a lot faster. You know, I do think the role is always evolving no matter what company you're at, just because business conditions are changing. But I think at a startup, you can kind of have a completely different, most important problem every maybe 6 months. Sometimes it's just, I need to think about X and now I need to think about Y. But sometimes it's, I need to be someone who's like the planner, who's so organized, who's putting the right systems into place. And then all of a sudden you need to become like the visionary leader who's like inspiring people. It can really kind of push you to grow maybe faster than not everyone's comfortable with the pace.
I mean, for folks who are at startups or have been at startups for a while in the audience, you're probably going to resonate with this. So often people join a seed company or a Series A or a Series B, and they find around later the company looks very different. Some people want to grow with that company, and some people want to have all this change and really keep growing with it. But some folks are really like, hey, I love a Series B startup. You know, I want a little bit of scale. Or maybe I love that Series A seeder. I want to build. And once we get to Series B, Series C, I'm like, there's too much red tape. It's not what I want anymore. And we see that happen at IC levels, but we also see it happen at management levels, where some folks will scale with the company and others will move forward on different areas.
Yeah, I really, honestly, I wish we were better at celebrating when people notice that dynamic and make the call for themselves that the company's no longer the right fit. At Honeycomb, we try to be really positive when people choose to leave. We always frame it as like a graduation and not like, this person quit or like, this person's leaving. We always say like, they graduated from the team, because we want them to feel positively about that chapter. We want them to sort of like close the book at a moment that like feels good and feels like they can celebrate it. And we want to make it clear that we don't expect anyone to stay forever. You know, I think sometimes people always feel like there's that one more important thing that they can't leave behind. And, you know, when you stay too long, I think it's not good for you, but a lot of times it also holds back growth at the company. It can be sometimes hard when you've really grown attached. When you've grown with the company, a lot of times you get really attached to the team, you get attached to the product, and you can stay in that situation where kind of the day-to-day isn't working for you for a long time. And I think we try to put as much positive framing around that as possible to remind people that it is a choice, right?
Are there particular signs that you've seen of when someone maybe does need to move on?
You know, it's hard to say. I think it manifests differently for each person. I got some advice from a coach at one point, which was, you feel this way now. Maybe you feel really strongly that something isn't working. And it can be hard to tell if that's just a momentary thing that's really bothering you or if something has really changed about the company. And she said, go to your calendar right now. Put a calendar reminder 30 and 90 days out. Write down how you feel. And then open, you know, when that calendar reminder pops back up, ask yourself, like, am I still in the exact same place? Or did I have a moment where I was frustrated with this one problem and it's actually pointed in the right direction?
That's a great perspective to kind of gather that qualitative data from yourself and say, you know, where am I here? Because it is easy to get frustrated in a moment. And, you know, sometimes other things in life are happening that are affecting how you're viewing your work. It's very common. How does that continue? Because if it becomes sustained, that's where you know there's an issue.
Yeah, exactly. When I've seen people realize that it's time, they realize that they have been upset about the same problems over and over. They kind of can't put them aside. They can't bring them to a resolution. And, you know, they look around and feel like their coworkers, they feel alone, right? They feel like their coworkers don't see this big problem I see. But the reality is like everyone else has a different perspective on it. And so I do think like checking back in with yourself to make sure that that perspective is sustained and that sort of delta from maybe the people around you is sustained is the thing that kind of helps you go, okay, like we have grown in different directions.
Yeah. And I think that alignment is something that is usually felt by others in the team, right? Like your manager probably sees that if you're feeling that way. And it is better to find the right spot for you instead of struggling to make it fit if this is a sustained issue. That said, there are ways that you can, you know, grow and prepare yourself for roles that scale like this. And, you know, startup VP of engineering is absolutely a role that will often scale from, you know, maybe you're hired at the Series A and you scale to Series B and you keep growing the team. It's an exciting time. How should people prepare to become a VP of engineering, whether at a startup or an enterprise?
You know, it's a great question. And I think a lot of people don't realize that they actually can start preparing before they get the role. You know, they sort of put the title up on a pedestal and then don't sort of break apart the skills that are involved. And I actually think even as a senior IC or engineering manager, or certainly as an engineering director, you can take on a lot of efforts that will help you be ready. And the biggest one is generally just sort of identifying a cross-organization management problem. And then, you know, going to your VP or going to your director and saying, hey, can I work on this? I didn't realize I could do that for so long. I always felt like I would be stepping on someone's toes. And now, you know, now that I'm on the other side, I'm like, yes, please. Like, please. Like, you want to solve a big, important problem and you just want some authority and support in doing it? Great. I'm here for you. And for me, you know, so often my job is a little kind of solo. So when someone wants to kind of partner and solve a big problem for the organization, it can be a lot of fun. You get to work together and then hopefully they get a little taste of what it's like to be in that role too.
Yeah, I think there are a couple ways to think about this. Like one, like solve your boss's problems. Don't be one. Like that's an obvious one, right? Like let's try to help solve their problems. And usually, I mean, people differ. Some people are very authoritarian or hierarchical and don't want you to take on problems yourself. And also differs culture to culture, whether that's, you know, internationally where you're working or company to company. But in startups, people want you to solve problems. That's what they hired you for. They're really excited for you to start solving. It's like, you identify this problem, you saw a problem that maybe I saw too, maybe I didn't, and you're going to go solve it. Awesome. Now, maybe I will give you some feedback and I'll solve it a different way slightly because I think there's this thing you're missing, this piece of context. But usually I'm just stoked you're doing it.
Yeah. And you touched on something really important, which is, you know, sometimes it is solve your boss's problems. But even more exciting than that is like, hey, I see this big problem that maybe you don't see from your vantage point. And, you know, I'm so used to it since I sort of grew with the company and so many of the folks on the team are people that like I hired or I worked with directly as a manager back in the day. Like I can have that sort of false sense that I still know how everything works in the organization. And it's actually changed a lot since I was up close with it. And when someone comes to me and they surprise me with a problem, like that's my favorite moment.
That is an awesome call out. And I think it's something we underrate because we think, oh, we have so much context. We're exposed to leadership. We also have been here for a while. We've scaled with the company and things are changing on the ground. And ICs have not just different frames, but also like depth in certain areas that maybe you don't have. And so do managers in different areas. So it's a wonderful call out. However, I also think there are skills that are really crucial to develop that are not just this problem solving piece. There's also the management skills. How can you start to develop those manager of manager skills as you work towards that next stage of your career, if that's what you want?
You know, for me, one of the hardest things was figuring out how to build the same degree of visibility of the organization as a manager of managers.
Tough.
Yeah. Like, you know, you're used to being able to kind of go verify directly. You know, you can look at pull requests. You can go talk to the engineer. The more you move up the ladder, the more it becomes really disruptive to do those things, or the more you create chaos by like, hey, I saw this on this PR. What does it mean? You know, like,
someone's going to be worried about that.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You don't want to be the problem. But it is a totally different skill to build that picture of what's actually happening in the organization and where things are working and not from secondary sources versus from going and talking to people directly. So sometimes it means, you know, it's a lot of reading status updates. It's trying to make sense of them. It's trying to verify that based on what you hear from other managers, but it can be a really different way of collecting information. And I do see some managers and managers who have never figured out how to make that leap. And I always feel like the end result is pain for their teams. So I think you could practice it. You can try to make sense of what's going on in like an adjacent part of the organization and sort of see what you come away with and try to develop that picture. So I think that like that piece is one you could try anywhere. I also think just sort of building your context about the business, even though it may not be directly related to the specifics of managing people who are managing people, it is one of those skills you're going to be trying to build at the same time. And it's nice to get the jump on that when it's not, you know, when you're not already in the hot seat.
Yeah. And I know a lot of folks who listen to this. We have a plenty of founders and CTOs, VPs of engineering. We also have a lot of folks who are maybe engineering managers and looking to kind of scale that senior engineering manager director level and say, I do want to be the manager of managers. You gave some great insights about how to approach building that skill set. If you were to give like a couple of actionable tips of like, okay, try this, try that, what would you say to those folks listening who are trying to build that skill set?
Number one is definitely just like literally pick a project or pick a part of the company and say, I'm going to develop a really nuanced picture of what's working and not working over there. And then, you know, I'm going to try to like read the status updates. I'm going to go try and look at the shipwork, look at the change log. I'm going to, you know, look at the metrics I can see in you know, Linear B or whatever our engineering metrics tool is, and then go talk to the manager of that team and go, hey, I'm just trying to understand this better and see how much like what you have come away with matches their perception.
You know, I hear you talk about archetypes. I've also heard that you like using personality tests in how you think about your organizational design and helping prepare people. How are you leveraging those?
So there's a backstory for our executive team about how we got into these. And, you know, there was a period where we had sort of hired, our exec team has a nice balance of sort of folks who grew into the role internally. And then we've hired a number of seasoned folks from outside of the company who have been VPs or C-levels before. And that's really nice. But, you know, it takes a while to get the group to gel. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we had gone through a period where we had brought on a couple of new executives who were new to the company, but not new to their jobs. We were sort of trying to figure out how to gel as a team. And I think it was our CEO, Christine Yen, who decided, you know, we started to do quarterly offsites as an exec team. And she was like, great, we're going to do a personality test and we're going to all talk about the results. And that's how we're going to get to know each other. I can't even remember which one it was at this point. It might've been Myers-Briggs. But somehow that started to become a recurring thing that we did almost every offsite. So there was like maybe a year and a half where every quarter when we got together, the thing we would do before we saw each other in person was take a personality test and then discuss the
results.
Was it
a new one, different time?
Yes, it was a different one each time.
Okay. Yeah. That's kind of fun, yeah.
Yeah, so we did Myers-Briggs, we did Insights of Discovery, we did the Working Genius Framework. At one point, I just to be cheeky, I got everyone to do their astrology chart.
Oh, yeah.
And I talked people through what that meant. And the funny thing is you get about as much value out of that as you do the other ones. At first, I was a little skeptical, but I really see judiciously deployed that there's real power for certain teams, especially for management teams in those tools. And so I have come around to, I think they're maybe not every quarter, but there's really good moments to deploy.
It's a great
them.
Conversation starter, if nothing else. Like, yes, it's not always going to be 100% accurate, but it can help you frame. And I think I've found also when I've done it, I'm not an advocate to spend much time on this, I agree, but it is kind of fun. You can say, okay, like for example, I got ENTJ, or I got INTJ, and I've gotten both on that Myers-Briggs test. Like, do I agree with that right now? Or is this a reflection of how I'm feeling in the moment? And interrogating that result is really interesting, I find.
Yeah. And another reason that I really like them, there's two situations that I'll deploy them in that I think not everyone thinks of when they think about these as tools. Number one is if you have a team that you think is really talented, but they're maybe lacking a little bit of self-confidence. Like sometimes, you know, those tests are really good at just sort of holding up a mirror, and this is going to sound silly, but like they just remind you that you are good at some things.
Yeah.
Or potentially, you know, we have a number of very senior engineers, and sometimes people could come into the company and feel this sense of, oh gosh, everyone here knows so much. Like, what can I contribute? And just reminding people, hey, you're a different shape. You know, no matter how much you respect your teammates, there's something you bring that they don't have can be really powerful and can really remind people that like as a team, you are, you know, bigger than the sum of the parts of the people on the team.
So you're stronger together.
Yeah, exactly. So that's one case. The other case, I think they can be really powerful for underrepresented employees who maybe, you know, because of biases in the workplace, people don't always recognize the sort of leadership skills they might bring because they're sort of expecting them to come in a different package. StrengthsFinder is actually my favorite framework for this. You know, I think certain people just, you know, jump to the conclusion that if you're strategic or you're ambitious or, you know, you're achiever, like you might look like something different. And, you know, because these tests are just, you know, you fill in the bubbles, you get the score, they can identify anyone as those things. You know, there's always like cultural biases and that kind of thing to worry about. But I still think that like they can be a really good tool for helping people see themselves in a way that maybe they haven't been stereotyped in the past. So I feel like sometimes they can kind of help level the playing field and help people see themselves in a way that they wouldn't.
I also like your point about the mix of personalities and skill sets you need on a team, because if everyone on a team is, you know, one Myers-Briggs category, that team probably has some issues. Like, strength got some strengths, but it's going to have some weaknesses too.
Yeah. And especially like it can be so easy to miss this until you see it like on the chart of your exec team. Like myself, our CEO, Christine Yen, and the COO, Jeff Gray, when we do the insights discovery profile, we're all blue, which means you're very analytical. You love to work with data. You know, you love to like solve problems and like make decisions. And when we're all like jamming, the three of us are like jamming on something together, it feels so good because we think the same way, but it's so easy for us to miss, you know, to sort of have blind spots and like miss that perspective that a coworker who thinks different way is going to add.
Well, I have to ask, since she's been a guest on the show before, what's Charity Majors?
That's a good question. Charity and I are generally opposites, which is kind of great because it means we work together well. There's a red one, which is sort of like, you just want to like go and get
you're
it done.
Fiery.
Yeah, okay, I think okay, like the tagline for that one is be brief, be bright, be gone or something like that. Like they want to get it done. They, you know, they're like, they'll be in awe of your brilliance. They'll encourage you. But they also are just like already moving on to the next thing with their minds. Totally different than the analytical blue where you just want to like stew in the data.
This is great. I'm going to have to go listen. We've actually done two episodes with Charity on previous seasons. I'm going to have to go back and listen to them in this context and be like, okay, you're red, I think. All right. How do you work with Emily here? How does this work? So this is wonderful. I really appreciate the perspectives you brought to this conversation about the changing role of VPs of engineering and how that impacts the rest of the executive team. And something else we should also mention is that there is a lot of change happening generally in the world right now. The role of a VP of engineering is changing. We're being asked more to be business leaders, not just bringing engineering efficiency, at least in many companies. Of course, it may vary as we brought up. What are you thinking about going into 2024, Emily, that you see changing either with the VP of engineering role or the technology space in general?
Yeah, I think, as you said, it certainly is a very interesting time. And it can be really hard to kind of even like at this point, put your finger in the air and kind of know where things are going.
Yes.
I'll say an interesting conversation that keeps popping up. I did a meetup a few months back that was with other engineering leaders and people were just sort of, you know, making conversation. It was one of the first in-person meetups a lot of people had been to in a number of years. And the question came out, is your board pressuring you to lay off 30% of your engineers
or more
and replace them with AI?
Yeah.
I have a lot of respect for our board. I think they bring a good sort of measured perspective to things and we are not getting that exact flavor of pressure. But a number of people just put their hands up and some people said, I'm being asked to lay off 50% of my team and replace them with AI. So that's definitely, whether you're excited about it or not, and I'm a little skeptical, it's something that people have to have an answer to.
I think that's a really great point. I talked to a CEO just in the last couple of days who told me that he had laid off 80% of his team. And yes, new innovation is down, but he's like, hey, we're keeping the lights on. You know, I'm still retaining the value. And I mean, that's a, you know, three rounds, brutally deep cuts. But there's a financial incentive for some of this behavior. And because of how most organizations are constructed, that will often happen. So it's important that we think about how we're allocating resources, both, you know, financial and human capital. I know it's a little demeaning to say it that way, but it's that conversation isn't going away.
Yeah, I think this is unfortunately like the painful fall back to reality, and a lot of teams are moving.
Yeah.
They're moving back to operating in the mode that they kind of maybe should have been all along. Like we should understand the impact of investments that we've made. We should make sure that we are spending our time and energy on the things that have the most business impact. Like we should make sure that we can look at our data and observe that that's really true. Those things sound so obvious when I say them out loud, but I think a lot of engineering teams kind of, you know, there was a real moment of pressure to just grow, and people really stopped focusing on those fundamentals.
Yeah. I mean, ZERP, zero interest rate phenomenon, right? Money was very cheap. Everyone was trying to hoover up engineering talent. We were seeing the big dogs, the Microsofts, the Googles, the Apples, the Facebooks of the world do that. And we were just going, oh, shoot, we gotta get our engineers in here.
I'm certainly not someone asking, you know, can we lay off the engineers and replace them with AI? I think that's, in general, I feel like that's quite a horrible approach. Mm-hmm. But I do think that, honestly, engineering as a craft is much more fun and much more engaging when you are trying to respond to business constraints. So that part I welcome.
Yeah, it's really interesting. We partnered with Google on their Dora research this year. That report's recently out. Highly recommend. But one of the interesting things that I heard Nathan Harvey, who's the head of Dora's team over at Google, talk about when he and I broke down the report is, okay, like we're seeing AI be leveraged in about 50% of the companies in our 33,000 person survey. That large portion, I mean, makes sense. It's really exploded. However, we don't have a clear correlation to efficiency gains at this point. Now, what they did find is a correlation to increased dev happiness. So we can imply that this probably means AI is being leveraged to help developers get rid of annoying tasks. I think there's a ton of opportunities for that. And maybe help devs feel more efficient or feel like they're not having to spend as much time on things that don't equate to value in their mind. So as someone who's a dev tools nerd myself, that gets me kind of excited. But there is so much pressure that you mentioned from shareholders, from the board, from CEOs and CFOs sometimes, quite often, to say, okay, well, we can be more efficient, we think. The data is not quite there that it's for sure bringing efficiency gains, though.
Yeah, that's a good call out. There are fundamentally some different philosophies, and I think people will have to kind of pick which one they align with. For us specifically at Honeycomb, Christine, our CEO, says we want to build like mecha suits and not like autonomous robots. Mm. We want to build tools that make people feel more awesome at their job and, make the things that they have to do easier, but they're sort of still in control. Because we think that like there are so many things about human judgment that just there's just not a good replacement for it. Especially, so much of what we do as engineers is about making challenging trade-offs. And you have so much context that I think is just very hard to translate at this point to a machine. I'm much more optimistic about those use cases that are about empowering humans and making their job better and easier than the ones that are like, how can you replace the people with code? Because I think it's the outcomes are quite different.
Yeah, I think you can replace processes with code sometimes. Like that's where I'm excited. Policy as code as an idea is a huge opportunity to cut down some of these process pieces. But in the end, I agree with you. I think, human decision-making, human context is important. And we will perform better if everyone gets a co-pilot-like thing for their job, whether that's an engineer, whether that's a marketer, like whether that's someone working in an entirely different role. Let's give everyone a tool that's tuned to how they need to approach the world to help them. Because, that's going to see a lot of efficiency gains. That's going to make people happier. It's going to, see these improvements. But there is this conversation happening where it's like, oh, well, why can't we just completely replace the humans? Because humans are expensive for a corporation because we have to spend the money. But I agree with you. I think it's a little short-sighted, at least for now. The tech doesn't seem to be there yet in my mind.
Yeah, I agree with that. There is one aspect of this that I welcome and I'm really excited about. And this is something that our CTO, Charity Majors, sort of clued me into, where she pointed out that all of these software teams building with AI, building with LLMs, they are starting to have to accept certain realities about production software that actually I think have been true for a long time. Mm. There's sort of myths that we tell ourselves about our software that haven't been true for a while. The idea that, our software is perfectly deterministic, that if the test pass, it works, that, once you ship it to production, what the software does doesn't change until you ship again. All of those things have become sort of like less and less true over time in the cloud era. And, LLMs really sort of put those issues in the forefront. And so, she's kind of excited, and I agree that I think we're going to have more of a conversation where we sort of evolve how we think about supporting software in production and how we ship. And I think that's going to be a really cool and interesting part of this.
Fantastic. Emily, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I appreciate the thoughtfulness with which you've approached this topic. And I hope everyone who's interested in being a VP of engineering in the audience has listened to this and has found some value. And maybe VPs of engineering in the audience are also getting some value from thinking about like, oh, how is my role different in my company? What archetype do I fit? Do you have any closing thoughts you want to share with the audience?
I think, one of the things I'm really excited about as I look out is just, I do think like there is a return to really wanting to make sense of the data that you're seeing. Like it is a moment that really calls for that.
Yeah.
And so I think that like all of a sudden, our tools become so much more important. They become so much more precious to us. And I always want to encourage people to sort of dream big for their tools. I think it's so easy to sort of get used to dealing with your tools in a certain way. And I think like the nice thing about AI is it's forced us to sort of re-envision what those experiences can be like. I think you can do that with everything you use. You don't necessarily have to limit it to, the AI that's coming to, replace typing in your text editor. So I think it's a good time to kind of look around and go, what else can we upgrade in our lives to make our jobs a little easier?
Yeah, well, it sounds like you think upgrading to Linear B is a good call. So I'll take the implied guess on that one. So thank you. Emily, where can our guests follow your work?
Oh, that's a good question. The social media landscape is very weird at the moment.
I believe we had David Yee, who we talked to earlier, and he called it the social media hellscape.
So. That feels very accurate. I think a good place to find me if you are on Blue Sky, I'm there at EA Nakashima. I think, you know, I'm also just all over the place at Honeycomb events. So come find me in a booth somewhere and I'd be very happy to talk to you about data and AI and anything else.
Awesome. That sounds great, Emily. Thanks for coming on the show and spending the time with us. I've really enjoyed it, Emily.
Thanks for having me.